From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. The leaders of Germany, France, Italy, and Romania are in Kyiv today, meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky is pleading with Europe and the United States for more weapons to fight off the Russians in eastern Ukraine. Just yesterday, President Biden said the U.S. would give another $1 billion to support the war effort. Yevhenia Kravchuk is a member of Ukraine's parliament in the same party as Zelensky. She is in Washington today asking lawmakers for help. Ms. Kravchuk, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So as you're in Washington, there are top European leaders in Ukraine today from Germany, France, Italy. They are trying to make it clear that they support the war effort. Are you convinced that Europe is still 100% behind you in this fight against Russia?
We've seen the big unity in Europe since the full-scale invasion that we haven't actually seen, you know, since 2014 when the annexation of Crimea happened and the war in Donbass started. Well, we see that European Union already gave six packages of the sanctions. Is it enough to win the war? I'm afraid not, because we would need to put even more economic pressure on Russia, so it would not have the money to do such war. And restock their military equipment. But also very important to have this partnership in military support because the war had changed since, March and even April. Russians concentrated in the front in Donetsk and Luhansk region at the east. So the front line is about 800 miles right now. And at some part of the front, we are outnumbered in military equipment like artillery, some MLRS systems, 1 to 10.
And that is why you're asking for these stronger artillery weapons. Give me an example. Tell us as vividly as you can just how necessary those weapons are on the front lines. How urgent is it?
Well, it is urgent because we're losing a couple hundred of soldiers every day because they cannot, you know, give the response. So that would save the lives of the soldiers, but also will give us opportunity. So, you know, that's why we've been asking. And it doesn't mean that we're not grateful for already what we got, because, you know, without that support, we would not be able to stay as, you know, as we are. And Russians would probably gone more territory. And I don't know, maybe it would be in Kyiv or something.
Let's shift gears just a moment here, because the larger question here is, how will this war end? And my question to you is, would you accept any peace settlement with Russia that includes giving up any of the territory in eastern Ukraine?
Well, I'm a member of parliament. I was elected by people. And the poll says that 82% of Ukrainians will never, you know, bargain the territories. But, you know, every war ends up with some sort of peace treaty. But when the counterparts, you know, when the countries that are in the conflict come to the table of negotiations, what is matters is the position on the battlefield. So Russians are not trying, you know, to move forward to take as much territory as they can. And our aim is not to let them happen and to counterattack and to liberate the land they've already taken after the February 24th. So that's what we're asking, for the better position for negotiations, because, you know, they'll come sooner or later. But we need to understand that Putin and Russia understands only the language of force. So, you know, when Macron is calling or Scholz is calling and, you know, the leaders of European countries asking, like, please stop the war, it doesn't work. Only the gun can stop, you know, Putin of going forward. And also,
that is exactly why I asked the question whether or not you feel support from Europe is as strong as you would like it to be, when some European leaders that you just mentioned are saying, let's get this over with.
You know, there is a gap between, you know, commitments and public statements and what we get on the ground. So if all of the leaders would do, you know, what they promised. For example, Germany promised, you know, tanks and other systems, but saying, you know, you'll receive them like in a few months, but we really need them right now because that's what makes the difference on the battlefield right now. So we need this unity to be, you know, more courageous, I would say. But there is a clear vision from our side and from our military side, how to make this operation and how to keep Russians out, because the weapons, the NATO caliber weapons, are much more precise. They're more powerful than what Russians have. But Russians just do have, you know, a big amount of the Soviet era style weapons.
Mm. Yevhenia Kravchuk is a member of the Ukrainian parliament, deputy head of the Servant of the People Party, the same party that President Zelensky belongs to. Thank you so much, Ms. Kravchuk. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Supporters and opponents of abortion rights are waiting for a ruling from the Supreme Court. It is expected to overturn Roe v. Wade. That 1973 decision established the constitutional right to abortion. Before that, many states banned abortion, though pregnant people sought them illegally and in some cases ended up with life-threatening complications. Carolina Cuellar of Texas Public Radio introduces us to a woman who had this experience when abortion was illegal and who fears others will face the same challenges that she did.
It was 1967 when Maggie unexpectedly found out she was pregnant, even though she was on birth control.
And I knew I couldn't handle the stress of being a young single parent.
She agreed to tell her story if I called her by an old nickname, because she fears harm from anti-abortion activists. Maggie grew up in South Texas during the 50s and the 60s.
We would talk about sex, just like any kids do, but we didn't really know that much.
At a big Texas university, she got her first serious boyfriend and became sexually active. She made the difficult decision to terminate the pregnancy. It was illegal then, but Maggie's cousin said she knew someone who'd had an abortion.
It turned out that she had gotten information about a clinic in Mexico, just across the border.
That experience wasn't uncommon back then, according to Carol Joffe, a professor specializing in reproductive health and abortion at the University of California, San Francisco.
The first thing women did in those days, if you had an unwanted pregnancy, you asked your friends.
Maggie's parents took her to the clinic.
It was a little building that had beds with curtains between them. And there wasn't an operating room. I was just taken to this little cubicle. And that's all I remember. They used anesthesia. Then my parents drove me home from there. And the same day, in the evening, I began to hemorrhage.
At the time, she didn't realize how serious that was.
My mother told me later that she just prayed all night. So instead of taking me to a doctor or a hospital, we just hoped.
According to Joffe, pre-Roe, abortions could be lonely and dangerous.
It was not rare to have complications. It was not rare for some people to have nobody to go to.
Like Maggie, many hesitated to go to the doctor, fearing judgment or legal repercussions.
I did this alone, without telling anyone, no friends. My parents clearly were so ashamed and felt the stigma so much that they asked me not to tell anyone, not even my siblings.
Then, in 1973, the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion. Maggie was relieved.
Our world finally was recognizing women as people responsible, in charge of their own bodies, and capable of making their own decisions.
Years later, after having children, she terminated another pregnancy. Her experience was totally different. She went to a legitimate doctor and felt there was less stigma.
When I went, I realized that it really was just quite a routine experience at that point.
Carol Joffe says abortions also became significantly safer.
Biggest change after Roe was a dramatic, dramatic drop in the number of deaths and injuries.
Initially, access increased in states around the country, including Texas, as clinics popped up. But as anti-abortion activism and legislation intensified, facilities here closed. In 1982, Texas had at least 128 abortion providers. 10 years later, by 1992, almost 50 had closed. By 2020, just 16 remained. Jaffe adds, with laws like Texas's SB 8, which bans abortion as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy, criminalization of abortion continues to rise.
After Roe goes, it will be even more so.
After last month's leaked draft opinion in the case of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, experts believe it's likely the Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade. Maggie fears this will lead people to once again seek dangerous, illegal abortions, or be forced to continue an unwanted pregnancy.
There will be a young woman just like me somewhere in Texas who finds herself alone in a situation she hadn't planned without the means of going one direction or another.
The final ruling from the Supreme Court is expected within the next few weeks. For Here and Now, I'm Carolina Cuellar.
One way to step back and try to make sense of this pandemic is literature. And it turns out one of the first great poems in English was written in the wake of the Black Death in the 14th century, which was estimated to have killed half of Europe. We're talking about the Canterbury Tales, a collection of stories by Geoffrey Chaucer. They're timeless. Some tales are still referenced in Hollywood today. And on a recent trip to London, I looked up some medieval scholars and asked them about this. And they all pointed me to one particular tale in the Canterbury Tales that's directly relevant to pandemic. And since the Canterbury Tales story begins in a pub, that is where I start, with a pint of ale and an English professor who has a glass of red wine.
Hello, I'm Sarah Sally. I teach medieval literature at King's College London. So we are here, we're in the George. So this is a 16th century half.
I meet up with Sarah Sally, Chaucer expert at the George Inn and Pub. It's old, even for London.
Lots of low ceilings, oak beams everywhere. And we are here because it's just a few steps from the Tabard Inn, which is where Chaucer's pilgrims set off from.
The Tabard Inn was a real inn back in the 14th century when Chaucer lived. It's in a part of London called Southwark, just below London Bridge. And this is where the Canterbury Tales stories begins, with a group of travelers, also known as pilgrims.
There's a group of 29 pilgrims, a very mixed group. It starts with the knight and his squire and their servant. We've got several members of the clergy. There's the wife of Bath, who everybody remembers, who's been married five times.
The concept of pilgrimage, a spiritual trip, is a big thing in Chaucer's day. It's right after the Black Death, a horrific bubonic plague that keeps recurring every so often, kind of like Omicron. And the pilgrims in this story, they head east from London to Canterbury Cathedral. Why? Well, to perhaps save their souls.
There's a deal in medieval Catholicism that most people will go to purgatory after they die. But there are ways to shorten this. You know, there are certain holy sites you can visit. The pilgrimage to Canterbury, for example, is a way to shorten your time in purgatory.
Sounds rather worth it, but it is a long trip. So our pilgrims, well, they could sing songs, I suppose, but the owner of the inn and pub has a better idea.
The innkeeper who is serving them, called Harry Bailey, who was a real innkeeper, he was really the landlord of the Tabard Inn, Chaucer must have known him. He gets so enthused by the company that he suggests that he will join them on the pilgrimage to Canterbury, and that on the way they will have a tale-telling competition.
Yay, storytelling contest. That's the Canterbury Tales. Now, let's pause for a bit of English class context. It's clear that this story is one of journeys, of new beginnings. Our travelers set out in the spring, in the month of April. Or as Chaucer would say it in Middle English, aprile.
One that aprile, with his shoeless suit, the drought of March hath pierced to the root.
That's another Canterbury Tales scholar, Marion Turner of Oxford. Turner says the idea of new life, of a meaningful life, is a big theme of Chaucer's. After all, he lost several family members to the Black Death.
He saw lots of people die very young. And one of the things that Chaucer's really interested in is the cycles of life and death, which might sound very, very basic, but it's something that Chaucer deals with, I think, in really profound ways. This idea of how do you cope with tragedy, you know, that you have to deal with the inevitability of change. Everything dies and new things are born.
In Chaucer's England, it's being turned upside down. See, this horrific plague kills so many workers that it creates new openings, new opportunities for survivors up and down the social ladder. The hierarchy breaks down. And suddenly people from all walks of life begin crashing into one another, just like our motley group of pilgrims in the Canterbury Tales.
We're all fascinated by films or books where you manage to create an environment in which people who we don't imagine naturally coming together, they get together and we watch them as if, I mean, that's also, I guess, what's happening often in reality TV, isn't it? Put these people in a bubble and watch them.
As I hear you talk about it, is that why these other moments in the arts where we have this kind of collection of people who don't go together so often works? I don't know, The Breakfast Club for a movie from my era.
Each one of us is a brain and an athlete
and a basket case, a princess
and a criminal.
Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club.
Yeah, I know. Really, Scott Tong? That is the best you can do? Throw out a Gen X film reference to a group of oddball American high schoolers in detention to an Oxford professor? But go Marion Turner. She gets the reference.
That's also the kind of detention, yeah, of the Breakfast Club, which is, yeah, also my era. It's a really clever move. So that's exactly what we see in the Canterbury Tales.
So in the book, as the pilgrims walk, they take turns telling stories. And the story most connected to the pandemic is called The Pardoner's Tale. And for that, we bring in Anthony Bale, medieval studies scholar at the University of London. And he joins me a few meters away from the original Tabard Inn, where Chaucer's pilgrims began their trek.
They would also have been just steps away from Southwark Cathedral, which is where we're sitting now, and Borough Market, which was a medieval market, still a market, selling various kinds of produce. In this area, there was a prison, there were theatres, there were prostitutes, stews, brothels.
The pilgrim telling the pardoner's tale is a man who sells pardons for the forgiveness of sins. Remember we talked about shortcuts to heaven? Well, that's his business. And the pardoner begins this story, cliche alert, about three guys walking into a bar.
They're sitting in the pub, getting drunk, playing dice, and they hear a bell of a funeral passing. And they ask the boy in the pub, you know, serving boy, what's that? And the boy tells them that it's someone who was in the pub just days previously and died very, very rapidly.
There's a deadly pandemic out there, kind of like today.
And the boy says, death has 1,000 slain, this pestilence, he says to them. He explains it to them. And this provides a kind of motivation then for the three drunk young men, the rioters, as Chaucer calls them, to go out looking for death. They are going to go and slay death.
So to get revenge against death, these drunk losers wander outside into the pandemic. Not very smart. And they meet an old man who tells them, you can find death over there under that tree. So they go over there, and they don't find death. They find a jackpot.
They find 8 bushels of gold florins. Florin was a coin at the time.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. It's a life-changing amount of money, as people say.
And their mission goes off the rails. Our three drunkards now focus on greed. They settle under the tree, and they send one of the guys into town to buy food.
While he's away, the two remaining young men, spoiler alert, by the way, they decide that when the young one comes back, they'll stab him, and so they only have to share the money between 2 rather than 3.
Yep, more money for us.
Meanwhile, the youngest one who's off in town gets some wine, but he also gets some poison, and he adds it to the wine, and he decides he's going to kill the other two.
It's all this spy versus spy. Yeah.
Exactly. And the pardoner is a very brilliant storyteller, and he's built this up as a great moment of suspense, and he actually tells this bit in just a few lines. The young one goes back, they stab him. To celebrate, they drink the wine. All three are dead.
All three are dead. They go to find death, and death finds them. It's a fable of pandemic and choices. Kinda current.
And it's the people who don't pay attention to the pandemic that then suffer for it. I was in London throughout the pandemic and throughout the lockdowns, and there were people who weren't wearing masks. There were people who are still wearing masks. I know that there were restaurants that were secretly open during the pandemic, or pubs that were secretly open during the pandemic. So we had, I think, this quite precise scene that you have in The Pardoner's Tale.
A tale that is directly referenced in Harry Potter, says Marianne Turner of Oxford.
This story was the inspiration of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Here's a clip from the 2010 movie.
They found their path blocked by a hooded figure. It was Death, and he felt cheated.
She has explicitly said that this was her inspiration, The Pardoner's Tale, where three brothers talk to Death and Death gives them different gifts which don't necessarily turn out to be gifts. And one of them is the invisibility cloak, and one of them is the Elder Wand, and the other one is this special stone.
Did I mention Marianne Turner is one cool English teacher?
It's an example of how Chaucer's stories continue to have huge and far-reaching influence today.
Which brings us back to our pub in South London, where our story and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales began, and to our medieval scholar Sarah Solly. And I ask her why she thinks the Canterbury Tales are still a thing.
Well, obviously there's the fart jokes.
She is well into her red wine at this point, as am I with my beer. But it's true. A couple of the Canterbury Tales drag us well into the English gutter.
You know, there is plenty of sex and fart jokes and lovely bits of daily life. But the structure of the Canterbury Tales as a whole is a very serious and ambitious attempt to understand the changes in society and to put them within a spiritual framework.
And that makes for some timeless stories and reflection in any pandemic, whether they're told in modern English or Chaucer's Middle English. And we'll go out with one last sample.
He hath a thousand slain this pestilence, and, maester, ere you come in his presence, may thinketh that it were necessary for to beware of such an adversary. Beeth ready for to mate him evermore. Thus taught me, my dam, I say no more.
In its effort to put the brakes on inflation, the Federal Reserve is once again raising its benchmark interest rate by 0.75 percentage point. That is the largest rate hike since 1994, and it comes after two other increases earlier this year. NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley is here to help us understand what that means for you. Scott, good to have you.
Great to be with you, Peter.
So on one hand, this is a tough choice for the Fed. They desperately want to slow inflation, but raising those rates could come at the cost of higher unemployment and other problems with the economy. How has Fed Chair Jerome Powell talked about that trade-off?
Well, he doesn't really see this as a trade-off. The Fed does have two jobs, which are often described as being sort of competing jobs, maximum employment and stable prices. For a lot of the pandemic, they focused much of their effort on getting employment up, putting people back to work. But now they really have all their energy going into trying to get back to stable prices. And while that may result in some uptick in unemployment, Jerome Powell has said, look, we're not going to have the kind of job market we want in the long term if we don't get control over this very high inflation.
One of the questions I know many people have after learning this news is about mortgage rates. They are not directly tied to the Fed rate, but there is some connection. And I know that some people buying a home this week are looking at a 6% interest rate for a 30-year loan. It was under 3% about a year ago. How is all of this affecting, or could it affect, the housing market?
Yeah, we just got a weekly survey from Freddie Mac, which shows mortgage rates have gone up about a half a point in just the last week. As you mentioned, they're about double what they were a year ago at this time. That translates to a substantial increase in the monthly payment, and it does crowd some people out of the housing market. Mortgage applications last week were down about 15% from what they were a year ago. They could fall further. Home builders are taking note of this. They broke ground on fewer new homes last month. They pulled fewer permits for future home construction. So the housing market is one of the most sensitive to rising interest rates. And it's really where we're seeing the impact of these Fed moves early, because the mortgage rates have gone up even in anticipation of what the Fed was going to do.
And as I said, this is not the first rate hike of the year. Do you see any parts of the U.S. economy where those earlier interest rate increases did their job, cooled inflation at all?
We should keep in mind that ordinarily interest rates affect the economy over a long period of time. There's typically about a year lag before this effect will be felt in a broad way in the economy. That's why this is a kind of a crude tool for the Fed to use. There's this long lead time, and that makes it very difficult to calibrate it just the way you'd like. We are seeing some early signs. For example, this week we learned that furniture and appliance sales were down last month. Often those go along with home purchases, so that may be tied into those higher mortgage rates. But in general, consumer spending has remained really strong. The nature of spending may have shifted, less stuff and more services, but consumers are still spending freely. That's something the Fed tracks very carefully because it's such a big driver of the economy, and they're not seeing much softening yet. Ultimately, it may take some softening in consumer spending in order to get prices under control.
NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In just a few days, we will observe Juneteenth, which goes back to June 19, 1865. That was 2 years after Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation and the day enslaved persons were declared free in Texas. And that effectively ended slavery in this country. Juneteenth celebrations began a year later in June of 1866, and last year President Biden declared the day a federal holiday. So, how to mark it? Well, with music, with dance, and with red-colored drinks. We have a new cookbook to talk about. Watermelon and Redbirds is about Juneteenth and food. And the author, Nicole Taylor, is with us. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you, Scott, so much for having me.
So can you remember your first Juneteenth?
I remember my first Juneteenth celebration so vividly. It was in a pocket park in Brooklyn, New York. And obviously, there were food vendors there. There was a stage with so many brilliant young people and community organizations performing. And what really, really brought in everything that's so special about Juneteenth, and there was a guy there with a mini pony, and young kids were doing pony rides. And that, to me, was like this deep connection to Texas culture and to everything that is good about Juneteenth.
Anything about the food that jumped out at you? You're like, God, this is different.
I remember ice cream being there and having ice cream vendors and ices. And I remember that so fondly that I made sure in this new cookbook that I have an entire chapter dedicated to snow cone, ice pops, and other very cool desserts.
Yeah, you have a whole section on gadgets, and one of them is you need to have a snow cone maker. So the cookbook does not aim to capture the moment of 1866. It brings in newer flavors, and I want to ask you, what modern influences are you showcasing in the cookbook?
You know, here's the thing about my cookbook. I definitely put a spin on the traditional African-American food table. For instance, sweet potato and sweet potato pies are something that you see in Americana culture and also in, you know, Black celebrations. But instead of doing a sweet potato pie, I was like, how can I take the taste and the spices of sweet potato and put it in a cocktail? So, voila, you have the sweet potato spritz, which is a sweet potato syrup. Typically, I would make it in the winter months. But I took this syrup and made it a summertime thing by adding sparkling white wine, a little vodka, and cappelletti. So this drink is a nod to the African-American table and also to Italian aperitivo culture. Another example would be the pesto and plum salad with grains. So who wants traditional collard greens stewed down on a hot summer day? I mean, some people may want that, but for me, I love to have the essence of those leafy greens. And so I made it into a beautiful pesto that can be tossed in, you know, stone fruit, and you can do fonio or couscous. And it's definitely a nod to all the foods that I grew up eating, you know, on Sunday or even a church anniversary.
Well, so many colors in your food. The cover of your book is so colorful. You talked about drinks. What is the importance of red colored drinks?
Oh my gosh, I love a red drink. Red drinks are what I call Black Americans' connection to other Black people around the globe. If you look on the western coast of Africa, and list particularly in Senegal, the national drink of Senegal is bisop, which is hibiscus steeped in water, maybe with a little sugar added and a little spices. That drinking ritual and that bright red color can be found right now in so many plantation cookbooks where you read stories about enslaved people having celebrations, and strawberry lemonade would be on the menu. Yeah. And so I honor what I grew up seeing, and that is red punch. You know, during happy times when we're all celebrating together and gathering around the punch bowl or the Big Ben with red soda.
And I love this line, "Who made the potato salad?" You say that line is uttered at least once at every Juneteenth gathering. You have a potato salad recipe. What's the key to yours?
I would say the key to a Southernish potato salad, and that is my potato salad in the book, you need acid. I add pickled banana peppers juice to my potato salad. The other key, which is not an ingredient, but it is when you salt your potatoes. As soon as they're hot and you take them out of the boiling water, you need to salt them then.
Why?
Well, you get the salt is just not sitting on top of the potato salad. It kind of infuses into all of the bits of the potato. It gets all of the umami in right at the perfect time.
So can I ask you about the title of the book, Watermelon and Redbirds? You know, we spoke to Bryant Terry about his book, Black Food, and he talked about how watermelon can be a loaded thing to say, a trope to describe the Black community. Why did you pick it?
Oh, wow. When I think of watermelon, I think about going to the grocery store with my aunt or my mom, and as soon as we would hit the door, there would be these giant cardboard boxes with watermelon. And I would help get one of those watermelons down. And what I knew is when we got home to cut the watermelon, it was going to be a communal thing. You would call a cousin and say, "We're cutting a watermelon. We just got the watermelon." That memory is the memory I lean into. But it's not lost on me that there are so many ugly images and so many racial tropes that are tied to a fruit that is just simply delicious. So that is why the first name is watermelon. And as I'm talking to you right now, a red bird appeared. My mom would tell me growing up, look up, there's a red bird. It's someone in our family coming back to say hello. And so for me, the red bird always symbolized good luck. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, it's symbolic of the past, the present, and the future. So I put those two things together, and I think it's a fitting title for this newly nationally recognized holiday.
Well, my mother-in-law, Sue Thayer, also has the same red bird story, so I look for them. Now, your book is not just recipes. You have an entire section of Juneteenth gadgets, and I love kitchen gadgets. But at the beginning of each chapter is also an essay, and there's one on festival and fair food. And the essay talks about how festivals and fairs are often a reminder of white supremacy attempting to control Black life.
I wanted to make sure that not only that I would tell all my gadget-loving friends that they needed to get, you know, a proper cherry pitter.
My mom has one. I still know my mom's cherry pitter.
Your mom is smart. and I wanted all my friends to know what I felt like was the best snow cone machine. But I also know it's important for all Americans to understand that for many African-Americans, it wasn't always so easy for folks to pick up and take their families to the fair. In Texas, it was not until the 1960s that Black people could go to the fair any day they wanted to. There was one night, and that was Negro Night. I wanted to mention that in the book because there's this thing with Black Americans, and that is the juxtaposition of joy and sorrow. In the toughest times, even in places like Buffalo right now, outside of Topps grocery store, as so many people hold space for a violent, disgusting act, there are folks who are barbecuing, frying fish. There's probably a boombox playing. There's still this communion and this space of joy in the midst of sorrow. So I tried to also bring that to light in this cookbook a bit, the history of Black folks doing just that.
Nicole Taylor is the author of Watermelon and Redbirds, a cookbook for Juneteenth and Black celebrations. And, you know, you had me at Apricot Lamb Chops. That's what I'm making for Juneteenth. Nicole Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Scott, for having me. And enjoy your Juneteenth spread.
I will. $5. That's the national average for a gallon of gas. But many of you already knew that. And many of you have heard talk of energy independence, which for decades has been brought up when gas prices are high. Hear the words of President Richard Nixon from 1973.
In the last third of this century, our independence will depend on maintaining and achieving self-sufficiency in energy.
President Nixon was laying out plans to reach energy independence by 1980. That is, to drill enough oil and refine enough gasoline to meet American demand. But most energy analysts suggest this idea, it's a myth. That's a word Jason Bordoff uses. He's founding director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Jason, welcome.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
So I guess to understand this, can we start with why our prices are so high right now? You oil experts say we Americans are paying $5 because of a faraway conflict. Russia invades Ukraine. Several countries put sanctions on Russian oil, so there's less Russian oil available for the world. Why does that show up at my pump?
Yeah, prices are high right now for two reasons. One, as you said, is there's a disruption in the global oil market. Second, you don't put oil into your car. You put gasoline or diesel into your car, and that requires refineries, and there's actually a shortage of refining capacity right now. Oil is priced in a global market. It's globally traded. It's relatively cheap to move around from one port to the next. And so if something happens halfway around the world that causes a disruption in the balance between supply and demand, that's going to show up in the global price, and the price we pay at the pump here in the U.S. reflects the global price.
Yeah. And how long has it been this fungible global market when, I guess, a lot of things have to happen, right? Pipelines and tankers and prices being available to everyone. A lot of things have to come together.
It's been many decades. You know, a half century ago, in that clip you played from Nixon, there wasn't a globally priced commodity market. Oil today is the most traded global commodity. Today, there's a bunch of traders looking at computer screens, and if they see that the price has changed a little bit, that you see it all the time. A tanker will be moving toward South America, and it'll turn around mid-ocean, and it'll head to Asia instead because they've discovered they can get a better price there. So we have a pretty integrated global market now.
Now, a lot of Americans and elected officials argue in the U.S., if we produced what we use, then we would be independent, as the argument goes. But you're describing us all kind of paying the same price around the world. So I want to ask you about a country like Norway. It produces way more oil than it uses. Norwegians are also paying the same sky-high world price as we speak?
They are, although they're not buying as much of that because Norway has been smart, and they drive a lot of electric cars there. So they have the highest percentage of new cars sold that are electric of any country in the world. But you're right, it's priced in a global market, and that means it doesn't really matter how much oil you produce or how much oil you import. What matters is how much oil you use. Mm-hmm. The United States went from importing two-thirds of the oil it uses about 10, 15 years ago to being a net exporter last year. So that is energy independence. But that doesn't help you at the pump when you go to fill up your car. You're still paying the global price.
Yeah, right, not independent from the price that everyone in the world is paying. So let me put this argument to you then. If, say, the U.S. drilled more oil from, say, Texas, couldn't that produce more supply for the whole world market, and therefore everyone in the world would pay less?
It would, and that's actually happening now. U.S. oil production this year, because prices are high, not because of anything the government is doing or not doing, but because prices are high, U.S. production is going to rise almost a million barrels a day. The world uses about 100 million a day. And that is more supply that is helping to displace the loss of Russian oil. If we want to turn the screws on Putin, you need that oil to come from somewhere else until we can transition away from oil. And that's the important message, is if we use less oil in the first place, we would be less vulnerable and more resilient to inevitable shocks in the global oil market. If it's not Russia, next time it'll be something else. Not to mention, that's what we need to do for climate change.
Yeah. Well, finally, Jason Bordoff, I want to ask you a bigger question about myths, like this myth that we can be independent of the world price here. You're an energy expert. You're not a behavioral scientist. You're not a psychologist, but with a myth like this, why do you think it persists? Why do politicians and others say it so frequently, but maybe more to the point, why do so many of us believe it when we hear it?
There are a bunch of reasons, but I think it kind of goes back again to that clip from Nixon. You know, right before the 1973 Arab oil embargo, if you did a poll of Americans, most did not know we imported much oil at all. And that was a real wake-up call for the country. First, the Arab oil embargo that led to lines at the gas station that are seared into our memory, then the Iran hostage crisis in 1979, another oil crisis with lines at the gas station, and a sense that as long as we were dependent on the Middle East for our oil and the political turmoil and the instability in many of those countries, we would have these shortages and price spikes here in the U.S. But that's not the case. The reality is it's a global market, and regardless of how much you're producing, you're still affected by what happens halfway around the world unless we use less oil in the first place, which again is what would make us most secure.
Yeah. That's Jason Bordoff, founding director of the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Jason, thanks for the time.
Thanks for the invitation.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.